emergency call numbers. Mishra says the fleet will continue running with all its might until the coronavirus is under full control in India. In Russia, drone enthusiasts have gathered in the capital Moscow to show off their technological creativity in a racing competition. The participants created their own drones and made changes to the models right on the site where the competition was held to improve their chances to win the contest. The goal was for the participants to complete the track in the shortest possible time. Participants say the interesting thing about the competition is that it's cheaper than other games.
It's a lot of fun. From the outside, it may not be so clear, but when you're inside it, it becomes really fun to talk, race with the competitors, learn from their experience some new technological things. As for the high cost, it is expensive, but when compared with the snowboards and skis, it is really cheaper, but more expensive than knitting.
In 2017, the International Federation of Aeronautics, or FAI, announced drone racing as an official sport. In 2018, Russia's sports ministry included drone racing in all Russian register of sports with a class code F3U following the FAI classification. Nowadays, phone addiction is causing an increasing number of accidents worldwide. A Korean engineer has come up with a creative, although satirical, way to tackle that issue. Pang Min-wung is a 28-year-old industrial designer. He has invented a robotic eyeball people can wear to avoid accidents when using their phones while walking. The device is strapped to the forehead and opens its eyelids when the users lower their heads. The third eye then beeps in warning when the user comes within 1 or 2 meters of an obstacle. Peng says his device is not a solution to the issue and hopes that people will understand the severity of their reliance on gadgets when they see the third eye.
A science professor has released spectacular drone footage of lava streaming from an Icelandic volcano. Sørensen Johnson flew a drone over the volcano 2 months after it started erupting. He captured close-up shots of lava bubbling in its crater in the southwest of Iceland's capital. The volcanologists say that they have no idea how long this eruption will continue, adding that magma could flow for years. Iceland is home to dozens of active volcanoes. Volcanic landscapes have turned into a tourist attraction in the Scandinavian country. Two Russian cosmonauts have conducted spacewalk outside the International Space Station to prepare an old docking module for disposal. The duo spent more than 7 hours outside the ISS to wrap up preparations for the eventual disposal of the PRIS docking compartment. According to NASA officials, the Russian cargo freighter will remove the two-decade-old module from the orbiting laboratory later this summer. Both the cargo ship and the PRIS will burn up in the atmosphere above the Pacific Ocean. The orbiting PRIS will clear the way for the arrival of a new Russian multipurpose laboratory module named Nuka, meaning science in Russian. Nuka is scheduled to launch on July the 15th this year. Wednesday's operation was the sixth spacewalk in 2021 in support of the Space Station Assembly, maintenance and upgrades.
A rare albino baby elephant that was rescued from poachers in South Africa has found a new home with a welcoming herd. The calf named Han Yi Sa was caught in a snare in the Kruger National Park when she was only 4 months old. She suffered several nasty wounds, including one to her mouth. Han Yi Sa remained trapped in the snare for 4 days before being rescued and taken to a shelter especially built for elephants northeast of Johannesburg. All the other elephants there are orphans too.
Each female that we had has a baby. So except for them, all of the others are orphaned. And I think that is part of the reason why they accept these orphans, because they know how it feels, you know, and they become actually, you know, the mother figures for them.
The calf has learned to adapt to the new life. She lies under the shadow cast by bigger elephants to protect herself from getting sunburned. The shelter says if the herd grows too big for the area, she and other elephants will be released into the wild.
The Light is a short bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields, like animals' life, cultural events, funny trendy news, and more from every corner of the world.
A Brazilian artist has found a way to reuse plastic bags in a very creative way, making something beautiful out of them. Eduardo Sroa turns recycled shreds of plastic into real pieces of artwork. He picks up the material from city streets and rivers. Without using a drop of paint, Sroa recreates paintings by Picasso, Van Gogh, and other famous artists. He says his goal is to draw attention to plastic pollution.
I present this series as a product that does not have paint, except for what has already been processed into plastic by the industry. It does not have glue. It is a box that was built, and inside I press and condense it. I make an accumulated cluster of plastic bags that ends up creating this image that you see.
Sura's exhibition is due to open in Sao Paulo in the coming months. His previous works were also aimed at raising awareness about the environment. He has created several giant installations in public places, mostly along polluted rivers.
Chinese archaeologists have unearthed a rare 3,000-year-old bronze figure from a site they have been excavating for months in Sichuan province. The 1.5-meter figure, deemed one of China's most famous archaeological discoveries. It consists of two parts. The upper part is 55 centimeters high, with a zoon, a vessel used in ancient times, on top of the head. The lower part is 60 centimeters in size, with kneeling posture. Similar findings in the past were just 20 centimeters in their heights. The bronze figure was discovered under massive ivory objects. So far, over 500 objects, including ivory, bronze, gold, and jade ware, have been found from six sacrificial pits of the Sanjiandu ruins. A Chinese man becomes the first blind Asian mountaineer to successfully scale the world's tallest peak, the Mount Everest. Zhang Hong completed the 8,849-meter high Himalayan feat with three high-altitude guides. The 46-year-old climber said he spent much of his trek holding onto his guide's arm. The pair said the most tiresome and risky areas were the so-called death zones, ice walls, and ice falls at around 8,000 meters. The Chinese climber recalled humbly embracing being part of Mother Nature after he completed his arduous journey.
No matter if you're disabled or normal, whether you have lost your eyesight or you have no legs or hands, it doesn't matter. As long as you have a strong mind, you can always complete anything that other people think you can't.
Zhang added that this is only the beginning. He said his next milestone is climbing the highest peaks from the world's continents known as the Seven Summits. The Chinese mountaineer lost his eyesight at the age of 21. After his success, he became the third visually impaired person to ever step foot on the Everest peak. A Russian company has developed a fully self-driving car that looks like it was taken right out of a sci-fi movie. Flip is the size of a conventional passenger car and has enough space for six people. Its creator says the advanced vehicle is a taxi of the future. Flip has fulfilled the requirements of international automated driving standards. It's powered by electricity, but it can also use other fuels like gas and hydrogen. The owners of this futuristic vehicle do not have to worry about running out of power. That's because its replaceable batteries can be changed in less than 5 minutes once they're out of electricity. A rare baby giraffe is born in a zoo in western France as conservationists try to increase the population of this endangered species. The cute Rothschild giraffe is the second born in a French zoo this year. Caretakers say the cubs will stay with the facility for 1 year before they would be sent to another site to start their own families. The Rothschild giraffes are critically endangered, and conservationists say that only 1,600 of them exist now. The general giraffe populations in the wild have also decreased by around 30% in the last 3 decades.
For many professional climbers, ascending Mount Everest for even once remains an almost distant dream. However, a Nepali man has achieved that feat not once or twice, but 25 times. Kami Rita Sherpa has arrived back in the capital, Kathmandu, after breaking his own whopping record of 24 ascents to the summit of the world's tallest mountain. The veteran climber hopes that his accomplishment represents a big achievement for his small country. Climbing tall mountains runs in Kami's blood. He belongs to the Sherpa tribe, one of the Tibetan ethnic groups and native to the most mountainous region of Nepal.
Now, the iconic Eiffel Tower in Paris has been illuminated for the first time using electricity produced from certified renewable hydrogen. In an amazing show, hydrogen-generated lights were projected onto the tower's frames, displaying various patterns and designs, making viewers ecstatic. It's a dream project of a French company based in the city of Saint-Malo. The company wanted to make the most recognizable landmark a showcase for its carbon-free technology. The objective is to bring more awareness of renewable energy to the public. The nightly event will continue until May the 30th. Countries around the world are investing a lot to develop hydrogen-related technologies.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish. We'll be right back.
in the limelight.
The German government is backing an extension of European Union carbon pricing that will end free carbon permits for airlines, putting pressure on the United Kingdom to put in place a similar package to meet climate targets. The European Commission will propose a dozen climate policies on 14th of July, each designed to slash greenhouse gases faster in line with an EU goal to cut net emissions by 55% by 2030 from 1990 levels. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Philip Inman. The piece is titled Pressure on UK as Germany Backs Ending Free Carbon Permits for Airlines. The German government is backing an extension of European Union carbon pricing that will end free carbon permits for airlines, putting pressure on the United Kingdom to put in place a similar package to meet climate targets. The European Commission will propose a dozen climate policies on 14th of July, each designed to slash greenhouse gas emissions faster in line with an EU goal to cut net emissions by 55% by 2030. From 1990 levels. The package will include reforms to the European Union carbon market and a border levy to impose carbon dioxide costs on imported goods. All the policies will need approval from EU governments and the European Parliament. Britain's Prime Minister Boris Johnson has pledged to give details of how the United Kingdom will meet climate targets ahead of the COP26 conference in Glasgow this year. Ministers are concerned that the costs of transition arrangements to reduce carbon dioxide emissions 78% by 2035 will dramatically force up the cost of fuel for transportation, including flying, potentially prompting protests and a backbench rebellion by Tory MPs. According to a document seen by Reuters news agency, Germany backed the Commission's plan to impose carbon dioxide prices on transport and heating in buildings through a separate system to the European Union's existing carbon market. The long-term goal should be to have a uniform cross-sector carbon price in the European Union, the document said. The carbon market forces factories, power plants and airlines to buy permits when they pollute in the European Union. Industry and airlines get some for free, shielding them from carbon prices that have soared to record highs this year. Meanwhile, the United Kingdom has created its own carbon pricing market since leaving the European Union, but it mostly follows the existing EU model and focuses on heavy industries and energy providers. Critics of carbon pricing say it has done little to curb greenhouse gas emissions after a collapse in the price during much of the last 10 years and the overuse of free permits, allowing firms to use energy at little extra cost. The price has risen sharply recently as economies have begun to recover from the coronavirus pandemic, coming close to caps put on the price by the European Union and the United Kingdom. Berlin this year imposed a national carbon dioxide levy on suppliers of heating and transport fuels, set at an initial €25 a ton. However, the plan to reform the EU-wide system and impose higher costs on heavy carbon users is facing pushback from some European Union governments and from some lawmakers, who fear it could translate into higher household fuel bills. Brussels is under pressure to come up with a compensation scheme to ensure governments have enough resources to address the policy's social impact, particularly on low-income households and people who rent their homes, Germany has said. The British government is going to face the same dilemma if it pushes the cost of carbon emissions onwards to customers, many of whom are on low incomes and already struggling to pay heating bills. Berlin said the reforms to the European Union's carbon market should prolong free carbon permits to an appropriate extent, but end them soon for aviation, the document showed. Analysts have said that to comply with World Trade Organization WTO rules, the European Union must phase out free permits when it introduces a carbon border levy on imported goods.
The subcontinent.
Hello everyone, this is Mehdi and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. Our program aims to address important issues in the subcontinent which affect the governments, people, organizations and the region as a whole. We will try to explain the issues, break down controversies surrounding them and try to have some external perspectives from experts and people.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we are going to talk about Imam Khomeini and the legacy of Iran's Islamic Revolution across the Asian subcontinent. And we shall take a look at the similarities of anti-imperialist movements under the leadership of Imam Khomeini and Mahatma Gandhi.
Every year in early June, Iranians and many other devotees from all over the world commemorate the death anniversary of Imam Khomeini, the revered founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Imam Khomeini is especially admired across the Asian subcontinent for his legacy of fighting for freedom from the imperialist powers in the world. Such a spirit is well known for the people of the subcontinent who rose against the British colonialism under the leadership of another charismatic revolutionary, Mahatma Gandhi.
Grand Ayatollah Sayyid Ruhollah Mousavi Khomeini, better known as Imam Khomeini, passed away on June 3, 1989, at the age of 87. He devoted many years of his life to standing up to the US-backed Pahlavi dynasty and grew to become the iconic leader of the Iranian nation's struggle in the 1970s against the centuries-old monarchical tyranny. He eventually paved the way for the downfall of the despotic regime in 1979. Every year, mourners from all walks of life converge on Imam Khomeini's mausoleum in southern Tehran to pay homage to the architect of the Islamic Revolution and renew allegiance to the ideals of the 1979 revolution. The Islamic Revolution was a long chain of events that culminated in the overthrow of the Shah of Iran and the establishment of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Its cause and message of awakening and resistance has been resonating with Muslims and non-Muslims who are oppressed by corrupt authorities even decades later. It was a momentous and epochal event in the modern history of Asia and Islam and had enormous social and political impacts across the subcontinent.
He has given the talisman of solidarity to the people of the world. How can we stand with the oppressed communities? And he has shown us that we may have to pay cost of standing with the opera, but we should not compromise, and we, without compromise, we should continue raising our voices for the operas of the world.
The ideology that was born out of the Islamic Revolution of Iran triggered a process of geopolitical realignment, whose influences remain to this very day. However, this hadn't been new for the people of subcontinent. Such a revolutionary and rebellious mindset had been the zeitgeist of the people since the British Raj. Similarities between the Iranian social uprising against the despotic Pahlavi regime and the endeavors that ended the British colonialist rule over the subcontinent can be traced back to the spiritual fathers of these movements. Both Imam Khomeini and Gandhi had been uniting beacons of hope for the oppressed people of the globe.
The revolutionary movements led by Imam Khomeini and Bapu Gandhi both started with the ultimate goal of terminating the control of imperialist pawns over their countries. Their vision of independence, based on religion, marked a sea change in political attitudes of world powers towards Asian countries. Both leaders became the icons of war against those who saw themselves as the lords of the world, those who felt entitled to install or remove rulers, assist in assassinations and coup d'etats, and change dynasties and subjugate the public.
Imam Khomeini and Mahatma Gandhi both are very different from other world leaders, as they both have criticized the Western liberal democracies, and they both envisage different kind of democracies to rule in respective countries. Unfortunately, many people, including Mahatma Gandhi, did not succeed in a way what he had in envisaged. He didn't see that implementing in the country the self-rule, the Swaraj. But Imam Khomeini succeeded in challenging the Western liberal democracy, the idea of Western liberal democracy, because it is hegemonic and homogenized. It doesn't allow, it is in a very good package, but it doesn't allow other diversity to flourish. So the different model challenging the governance and the democratic model, the dominant model, is what I think is our leaders thought, and we have similarities.
Ayatollah Khomeini and Mahatma Gandhi liberated their countries from the evils of Western imperialism and transformed the politics of the region and its relation with the West forever.
Like many other leaders of popular uprisings, Imam Khomeini and Gandhi endured long periods of incarceration or exile, making them champions of grassroots movements that ultimately put an end to the foreigners' rule over their people. Both leaders were known to live a very simple life in a modest house, as they never let the love of power and wealth take over their hearts.
Under the guidance of Imam Khomeini, the Iranian Revolution was inspirational for the world as a promise of freedom, while it created waves of awakening in other countries of the region. It was an ideological revolution and therefore knew no material borders, only spiritual ones. Hence, right from the beginning, Imam Khomeini did not limit the revolution only to Iran. It was not only a call for national unity, but an ideological or global unity against the colonialism of the Western tyrants. The British colonization of India in 1858 precipitated the collapse of the classic Islamic civilization, and by early 20th century, almost the entire Muslim world was colonized by expansionist, oil-hungry European powers. The Ottoman Empire was the last representative of the classic Islamic civilization that collapsed after World War I in 1918. Therefore, the first half of 20th century saw many Muslim nations fight to regain their independence.
Through their patience and wisdom, Gandhi and Khomeini revived the freedom-seeking anti-imperialist mentality in their respective countries. They managed to alter the geopolitics of Asia and the entire global order, while their ideals are bound to inspire revolutionaries for years to come.
In addition to the similar anti-imperialistic spirit that is rooted in the Iranian Revolution and Indian popular uprising, Pakistan and Afghanistan felt the impacts of the establishment of Iran's Shia Muslim government even more because of their close proximity to the epicenter of the revolution. In Pakistan, the news of Iran's revolution was hailed as a victory for Islam, and the press was largely favorable towards the new government. Back then, General Zia-ul-Haq described Imam Khomeini as a symbol of Islamic insurgents. According to analysts, Imam Khomeini's respect and reach in Pakistan was greater than the country's longest-serving head of state, General Zia-ul-Haq himself. Throughout the 1980s and 90s, Islamic political parties and movements kept popping up in almost all Muslim countries because Imam Khomeini proved that a non-secular Islamic model was not just a dream, it was a reality. Like Gandhi, Imam Khomeini proved that it was possible to take on the West, revolt against their collaborating monarchs, and defeat dictators.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Now to have more insight, we are joined by Rashid Maghbool, senior journalist. First of all, I would like to thank Mr. Maghbool for being on the program, and let's begin by asking, how is Imam Khomeini known across the world, especially the subcontinent, and how much of an influence has he had in India or Pakistan?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Thank you very much for giving me a chance to speak on this show and speak about such a great personality whose life has influenced and continues to influence millions of people across the globe. As far as this question is concerned, the world opinion about Imam Khomeini has always been mixed, and it continues to be mixed. There are people who criticized him then, and criticize him now. And then there are people who loved him then and who love him now and who followed him then and follow him now. But when we look towards the Europe or America, who is the arch rival of Imam Khomeini's Iran and Imam Khomeini's philosophy, even in that camp in the Western world, we see people who even if they criticize him or disagree with him, but they cannot stop praising him for many different qualities that Imam Khomeini possessed. I am recalled of an interview that a professor emeritus of Princeton University, Richard Falk, did with Imam Khomeini a day before Imam was supposed to return to Iran. And this interview took place in Paris. Richard has written about it. And in his writing, he says that, I mean, the words that he used, that he has used for Imam Khomeini are actually remarkable. He says that he found Imam Khomeini as a person with active mind and sharp intelligence. And then he says that, he was quite awake to the realities of the world. And also that he was very clear in his mind that what he wants, and then there are so many other academics. I mean, you know, the much celebrated philosopher of West, Foucault, his kind of work on Imam Khomeini or the Iranian Revolution. And we there are so many others, the academics and the journalists or the opinion makers in the West also, who again I say, who may disagree with Imam Khomeini's ideas, but they are still found in awe of his personality. I can tell you that, as we say in English, that love him or hate him, but you can't ignore him. So far as subcontinent is concerned, it is not hidden from anyone. I mean, anyone can see it with open eyes that Imam Khomeini continues to be a reference point for the people in the Muslim world and in subcontinent as well.
Do you see any similarities between the father of the Iranian Revolution, Imam Khomeini, and the fathers of the Indian rise to independence from colonialism, like Gandhi or Nehru?
Yeah. First, there is this correction that as far as Gandhi is concerned, M.K. Gandhi, he is officially the father of the nation in India, and it is widely accepted as the leader of the freedom struggle in India. But that status has not been accorded to Nehru, although Nehru was one of the important leaders of the freedom struggle of India. So that is one. Second, yes, there are similarities that you can find between Mr. Gandhi and Imam Khomeini, in the sense that Gandhi, when you look at his struggle, which he started, you know, after he came back from South Africa, he also used religion, you know, as a tool for the awakening of the people of India, and he also, through his moral lectures and by invoking religion, he also instilled the passionate confidence and hope in the people of India, which prepared them to fight against the imperial powers. And he also, you know, created this whole idea and structure of self-reliance, you know, the Swadeshi movement, the indigenous cultural movement, economic movement, you know, total self-reliance, and in politics also. So, so in that sense, you can compare, you know, you can see similarities between that methodology of both the leaders. I mean, in the same way you see Imam Khomeini used spirituality and religion to awaken the masses, to instill confidence in them, to raise back the dead hopes of winning over the evil and getting back what is rightfully theirs. So in that sense, yes, you can find the similarity, but it is very important for me to tell you that as far as some of the tragic events of our part of the world are concerned, like partition of India and especially the Kashmir imbroglio.
Thank you, Mr. Maqbool. Now let's take a break and take a look at how the global media has covered this subject.
Arguing that Ruhollah Khomeini was the Gandhi of Iran, this article examines how Americans perceived the Iranian Revolution and shows how many influential individuals failed to understand or acknowledge the true nature of the Shia opposition led by Imam Khomeini. The author finds the answer to these questions in the antipathy that many Americans had for the authoritarian rule for the Shah. Professor Kapil Kumar, who is the chair of the History School of Social Sciences at Indira Gandhi National Open University, IGNOU, in New Delhi, says Imam Khomeini went for massive mobilization of people, which was the second example in Asia after Mahatma Gandhi. However, Imam's total call was based on religion, as he was a practicing clergy, and Gandhi did use all religions to unite Indians, but he failed to stop the partition of the Indian subcontinent on the lines of religion. While Imam Khomeini succeeded in Iran, Mahatma Gandhi failed in India. Imam Khomeini and Mahatma Gandhi are among the leaders who used the theory of non-violence in their struggles. The findings of this paper indicate that both Imam Khomeini and Mahatma Gandhi believed in non-violence and applied this method in their struggles. It also says the idea of non-violence has its roots in the religious teachings the two leaders followed, and the anthropology of both the leaders, despite stemming from different fundamentals.
And one last question, Mr. Maqbool, for you. What is Imam Khomeini and the Iranian Revolution associated with?
It is associated with many things. Like, as I said, and I repeat, and it's very important, that it is associated with the feeling and with the conviction that you can stand up to the arrogant powers and you can win also. And it is associated with this belief that you can create your own path and you can stand for your conviction. And then it is most importantly, it is associated with the most important thing, trust in Allah, the unshakable faith in the Creator, and spiritually guided and aided movement is the best way to seek rights and get justice. That's what it stands for. And it is associated with hope for humanity. Humanity, I say. And especially for the Muslim world, it stands and it is associated with a hope for better future, for honorable and dignified life, and taking control of your own affairs. That's what it is associated with. The honor that people have lost, the dignity that people have lost. So it is associated with the greatest value of humanity and Islam and Quran, which is ghairat. It tells me, I mean, how it touched me. I tell you that I consider myself very lucky, and I thank Allah for this, that I'm an 80s born person, that I shared this time and space with that great personality, you know, just for some little time, in the sense that I was also breathing in this world when he was around somewhere in Iran.
There you have it, Mr. Maqbool, senior journalist from Kashmir. Thank you for your precious time, sir. Now let's see how the people have reacted on social media and cyberspace.
Saim Raza has expressed his respect and admiration for both leaders, noting that such icons never truly die. Hasnain Husseini says Imam Khomeini's ideals for an Islamic society should be actualized in Muslim countries, noting that such guidelines can solve all the problems that Pakistan is facing. Moid Pirzada has extolled Imam Khomeini's political visions for their lasting power throughout the global political system, even decades after his demise.
And that was our special episode for the death anniversary of the great leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution and his impacts and connections to the freedom-seeking movements across the subcontinent. Thank you. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take care.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight.
An American contractor went to a small town in the Guatemalan mountains with an ambitious goal: to ignite the local economy and hopefully even persuade local people not to migrate north to the United States. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Natalie Kittreff and Michael Shear. The piece is titled, USA to Central America Hasn't Slowed Migration. Can Kamala Harris? An contractor went to a small town in the Guatemalan mountains with an ambitious goal: to ignite the local economy and hopefully even to persuade local people not to migrate northwards to the United States. Half an hour into his meeting with coffee growers in Guatemala, the contractor excitedly revealed the tool he had brought to change their lives: a pamphlet inviting the farmers to download an app to check coffee prices and be part of modern agriculture. Pedro Aguilar, a coffee farmer who hadn't asked for the training and didn't see how it would keep anyone from heading to the border, looked confused. Eyeing the US government logo on the pamphlet, he began waving it around, asking if anyone had a phone number to call the Americans and tell them what our needs really are. "They've never helped me," Pedro Aguilar said after a training a few weeks ago, referring to American aid programs intended to spur the economy and prevent migration. "Where does all the money go? Where's the aid? Who knows?" As Vice President, Joseph R. Biden Jr. led an enormous push to deter people from crossing into the United States by devoting hundreds of millions of dollars to Central America, hoping to make the region more tolerable for the poor, so that fewer poor people would abandon it. Now, as President Biden, he's doubling down on that strategy once again and assigning his own Vice President, Kamala Harris, the prickly challenge of carrying out his plan to commit $4 billion in a remarkably similar approach as she traveled to the region on Sunday, 6th of June. "When I was Vice President, I focused on providing the help needed to address these root causes of migration," Joe Biden said in a recent speech to Congress. "It helped keep people in their own countries instead of being forced to leave. Our plan worked." But the numbers tell a very different story. After years of the United States flooding Central America with aid, migration from the region soared in 2019 and is on the upswing once again. in Guatemala, which has received more than $1.6 billion in American aid over the last 10 years, poverty rates have risen. Malnutrition has become a national crisis. Corruption is unbridled. And the country is sending more unaccompanied children to the United States than anywhere else in the world. That is the stark reality facing Vice President Kamala Harris as she assumes responsibility for expanding the same kind of aid programs that have struggled to stem migration in the past. It is a challenge that initially frustrated her top political aides, some of whom viewed the assignment from Joe Biden as one that would inevitably set her up for failure in the first months of her tenure. Her allies worried that she would be expected to solve the entire immigration crisis, irked that the early reports of her new duties appeared to hold her responsible for juggling the recent surge of children crossing the border without adults. Kamala Harris, who has little foreign policy experience and no history in the region, has already been criticized for not visiting the border. At a recent news conference, a group of Republicans displayed a milk carton that has been mocked up to show a picture of Kamala Harris with the headline, "Missing at the Border," even as she held a news conference with reporters detailing her plans to visit the region. The political risks are evident, including the obvious pitfalls of investing billions of dollars in a region where the president of Honduras has been linked to drug traffickers and accused of embezzling American aid money. The leader of El Salvador has been denounced for trampling democratic norms. And the government of Guatemala has been criticized for persecuting officials who are fighting corruption. Even so, Kamala Harris and her advisors have warmed to the task, according to several people familiar with her thinking in the White House. They say it will give her a chance to dive squarely into foreign policy and prove that she can pass the commander-in-chief test, negotiating with world leaders on a global stage to confront one of America's most intractable issues. That test began on Sunday, 6th of June, when Kamala Harris embarked on her first international trip to Guatemala and onward to Mexico, where she's expected to detail efforts to reduce migration to the United States by seeking to improve conditions in those countries. Injustice is a root cause of migration, Kamala Harris said during a White House meeting on 19th of May, with four women who fought corruption in Guatemala. It is causing the people of the region to leave their homes involuntarily, meaning they don't want to leave, but they're fleeing. While White House officials say their push to help Central America can do a tremendous amount of good, there is growing recognition inside the Biden administration that all the money spent in the region has not made enough of a difference to keep people from migrating, according to several administration officials and others with knowledge of the discussions. "We've looked extensively at different programs that have been approached," said Nancy McEldany, a longtime diplomat who serves as Kamala Harris's national security advisor. She obviously has learned a lot from then Vice President Joe Biden did. "And so we're very mindful of the need to learn of both positive and negative what has happened in the past. Foreign aid is often a difficult and at times flawed tool for achieving American interests abroad, but it's unclear whether there are any simple alternatives for the Biden administration." Former President Donald Trump's solution to migration centered on draconian policies that critics denounced as unlawful and inhumane. Moreover, members of the current administration contend that Donald Trump's decision to freeze a proportion of the aid to the region in 2019 ended up blunting the impact of the work being done to improve conditions there. But experts say the reasons that years of aid have not curbed migration run far deeper than that. In particular, they note that much of the money is handed over to American companies, which swallow up a lot of it for salaries, expenses, and profits, often before any services are delivered to local people. From 2016 to 2020, 80% of the American financed development projects in Central America were entrusted to American contractors, according to data provided by the U.S. Agency for International Development. The upside is that these companies have big offices capable of meeting the strict oversight requirements involved in handling millions of taxpayer dollars. The downside, critics say, is that a lot of money disappears into those bureaucracies instead of reaching the people they're trying to help. Half a dozen development experts who have worked with or for the contractors said the companies could easily take about 50% of the aid money they receive and direct it towards overheads, including generous salaries for their executives and company profits. When asked about that figure, USAID did not contest it. "It's a business," said Carlos Ponce, a professor of nonprofit management at Columbia University, who has worked for several U.S.-funded programs in the region. "And the same implementers win their contracts again and again, despite having implemented badly in the past, not showing any level of impact and not changing anything." USAID would not provide an estimate of how much taxpayer money spent on specific projects in Central America gets eaten up by administrative costs, noting that the agency is legally restricted from sharing its partners' proprietary information. "It's an incredibly not transparent situation," said Eric Olson, an expert on foreign aid to Central America at the Seattle International Foundation. Eric Olson added, "It's like this is a national secret." Kamala Harris's aides say she wants to make absolutely sure that as much assistance as possible heads directly to the communities it is intended for. She's concerned to make sure that we're getting maximum benefit for every single dollar that we spend, Ms. McEldowney said. Asked whether that included scrutinizing the money flowing to U.S. contractors, she said, "We're looking at that issue." Even when aid money reached Guatemala in recent years, it often brought little change, according to interviews with dozens of people who worked with or received assistance from U.S. finance projects in the country's Western Highlands. One, called the Rural Value Chains Project, spent part of its $20 million in American aid building outhouses for potato farmers, many of which were quickly abandoned or torn apart for scrap metal. "This brings no value to the people," said Arturo Cabrera, a local government official, peeking into an unused outhouse. "It doesn't generate income, which is what people ultimately need," he added.